Hi, I'm Jack.
And I'm Kevin.
This is Good Company in the Car.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it. Can't help it, the girl can't help it. She walks
by the meat. Hi, Jackson Pollock. I haven't done that in years, but I can't help myself.
Years?
Years.
I was just recently listening to the beginnings of a lot of the episodes. It hasn't been that long since.
It's been years.
Okay. Very funny. So listen.
All right, take it away. You have the talking stick.
As Good Company in the Car listeners will know, I like games. I like board games. I like cards. I like stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and whenever I see a new game, I want to play it. We were talking recently about, Kevin was saying that, there's a thing that I wanted to post on the Facebook page about, it takes 3 hours for somebody in interrogation to be convinced that they murdered somebody, even if they're completely innocent.
Mm-hmm.
It could take 3 hours, and so, because you hear it all the time. Well, I said I did it, but I didn't.
False confessions, coercion.
Okay. So there are lots of games that do that. And Kevin was talking about this study where.
It's a very famous study, and it was done in the 70s, and I think it was like Berkeley. And there were 7 subjects in this experiment. 6 of them were in on the experiment, and 1 guy wasn't. And they're shown different things like lines or images. And at first, everybody agrees that's the darkest image. That's the longest line. That's the smallest dot. And then as they go on, the group that are in on the experiment start pointing out that's the shortest line when it's the second to shortest line. And the guy, whoever is the actual person who's being in the experiment, will resist. But after 3 or 4 times, and you can watch it, it's on YouTube, a couple of these experiments, you'll see them start to not trust their own judgment, and they'll go along with the group, and they'll say, you know, is that the shortest line? That's the shortest line, all right, and it's clearly not.
Right.
And this is sort of the same thing, is you can get convinced.
Subjectability?
I think so.
So there's another...
Suggestibility,
that's the right word. So there's another course of videos that I'm sure you can find them. I don't know their actual name, but it says, watch this video, and in the video, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on, and you're supposed to watch the video, and it's only like a minute or two or something like that, and then it says, did you see the gorilla? And you're like, wait, what? You watch the whole video and you didn't see the gorilla.
Yeah.
And you go back and watch the video again, and sure enough, there's a gorilla in the background or something that is obvious, but you're not focused on that because you're focused on something else in the video. And it's that thing. It's like I've actually gotten into fights with people, not fights, you know, arguments, mm-hmm. where I've said, this happened this way, 1, 2, 3. And they're like, no, it was 3, 2, 1. And I've been, no, it was 1, 2, 3. Because when I think I'm right about something, I will not back down.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, you won't.
Kevin's never experienced that. So,
that guy Tony Robbins, he was on the podcast with that comedian you like. He's a redneck. He's got a mullet, and
Theo Vaughn.
Yes. And he was talking to him. He did this little experiment with him. He said, "Okay, look around the room and try to identify as many things as you can that are red." And then he's like, "Yeah." And he's like, "How many things in the room are yellow?" And he's like, what?
Ooh.
And he's like, you were looking for red.
Right.
And then he said, and how many things did you, that were actually kind of, they were beige, but you called them red so you could just have them, you know, more items? He's like, yeah. It was a way of perceiving things.
Because the human brain is suggestible.
It's what you're looking for. Yeah. And he said, you will, in your life, you will look for confirmation of failure or negativity rather when there's more positive feedback coming in. But if you're looking for the negative, it was the whole thing. But anyway, keep going.
There's a thing that like, well, you know, my life just sucks and everything's bad. And they're like, well, wait a minute. Didn't you just get a raise? Did you
do this?
Because people focus on certain things. So my current focus is trying to be happy, trying to be upbeat, trying to be all this kind of stuff. And, you know, of course, I'm like, oh, my car wouldn't start.
How about that guy walking his dog who was so frail and feeble that he was practically dragging him down the road? Did that make you feel?
Listen, as the Good Company in the Car people will know.
Animal,
you could punch a nun in the face, but
don't you dare mistreat a dog.
This man was walking his dog. He was walking faster than the dog. So, like, my dog walks yards ahead of me. This guy was walking ahead of the dog, pulling the leash to get the dog to keep up with him. And the dog was a little older, and he was dragging, like he was walking, but when he would lift his back legs, his feet were dragging.
It was all you could do.
It was everything, because I didn't want to be, you're fucking dragging that dog.
Yeah. And get off my lawn.
I know, exactly. So anyway, so all of this is leading about to, I found this new game, and I really, really want it. And it's called Werewolf. And the gist of the game is a party game for devious people.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not exactly sure of all the details because I just discovered this, but it's basically a trying to for allows up to 35 players.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a party.
And
shit, you can
have 35, that sounds like fun.
You have a, so what the gist is you have, of these 35 people, you assign people. Unknown to the other people,
uh-huh.
You assign people roles. There's townspeople, there's a doctor, there's a cop, there's other, and two
people. I want to be a lawyer.
Two people are werewolves.
Oh, fun.
So in the gist of the story, if the people pick out the werewolves, or if the werewolves can kill off all but two people.
Oh, wow.
So I, of course, am all in. I'm already on this no buy thing. I'm not supposed to be buying anything.
No, you're not.
I'm not supposed to be buying anything. And I want this game so bad. So anyway, so the gist is when the moderator says, okay, everybody stop. You have to play with people who don't cheat, because if you play with people who cheat, it's gonna ruin everything. So at the pause moment, everybody is supposed to close their eyes or cover their eyes or whatever, except for the two werewolves.
Mm-hmm.
And then the two werewolves pick somebody out to kill.
Uh-huh.
And the two of them will, like, you know, point or whatever they do to acknowledge who the next person is. And the gist of the game is that what is it called when you have a group of people who don't know what they're talking about in a mob forms? There's a word for it. So what happens is the other people at the party basically form an angry mob.
Uh-huh.
So the whole gist is the werewolves are trying to kill the people off, and they will start, well, wait, it's him. I know it's him. And
so after they pick two people, right, everybody opens their eyes back up. The two victims are on the ground, but nobody knows who killed them.
Correct.
Okay.
So that is the gist of
fun.
The moderator says, okay, you and you are dead. The werewolves got you.
Yeah.
I think this is a fabulous game.
That'd be a fun time.
Now, the funniest part about all this is, as I will gesture my hand elegantly towards the game closet, I have a closet in the basement that is filled from the floor to the ceiling with board games.
We don't need another game.
I don't ever play board games with anybody because getting people
together. That'd be a fun party game.
Getting people together to play board games is a pain in the ass.
But that'd be fun at a cocktail party.
Oh, it would be fun. Because you all know that recently, last year, I orchestrated, well, there was a get-together in the Outer Banks with...
we played Clue.
10 of our closest friends. 12 of us?
Well, there were 12 people total. There, yeah.
And we basically played Clue the whole week. And it was, you're the murderer, kill people.
Yeah, each day somebody got to be the murderer. Nobody knew who it was.
Well, initially it was supposed to... Yeah, yes. So
that's
it turned
we
into
modified
a fun
it.
Game. I had big props for fun, and it was a lot of fun. So at any rate, so all of this is about, let's kill people and get away with it games.
I have a question for you now.
Oh,
Before Christy had a car,
my sister,
what was her primary mode of transportation? Did your parents just drive her? She had a bike, right?
She had a bicycle.
And my friends at the Elks, who are older than me, they had summer jobs, and what they relied on consistently, Dick Dorsey in particular, he worked at the country club. He worked over at Congressional Country Club, and he lived in Wheaton, so that's a good 10 miles,
right?
He relied on hitchhiking. Hitchhiking. Did your sister ever hitchhike?
My sister, to the best of my knowledge, did not hitchhike. I would never hitchhike.
Right.
But my sister, when she was living in Morgantown, which is where WVU is, she would pick up hitchhikers.
That's the stuff of horror films. I remember when I was a little kid, you know, I told my mom, me and Chipper Denning are going to hitchhike, and she was like, no, you don't
right.
do that. And And I did hitchhike when I was in Europe with my friend Bartosek. We hitchhiked across
hysterical.
Ireland and England and France. We literally hitchhiked, and it worked. But there were two of us. Now, today's episode, Cold Case Files, there's a young woman in Seattle. She's 14, and this is 1973 Seattle. That's the most crime-ridden place on the planet in time.
And it's funny, though, it because you say 1973, and I literally kind of go, yeah, people hitchhiked then. You hitchhiked back then.
Oh, God.
You don't do it now, but you could do it back then.
So this is Cold Case Files.
Cold Case Files.
A runaway found murdered in the woods. I couldn't find the episode number.
Runaway found murder in the woods.
So we're in Seattle, Washington. It's November 25th.
A horrible place I never want to go.
Terrifying place, 1973.
It rains all the time. There's the highest level of suicide in the country is in Seattle.
And serial killers.
And it's the home place of Starbucks. Why would anybody want to go there?
Hold on 1 second. Oh. It was season 3, episode 15.
Season 3, episode 15.
I was feeling too slack. So we are, it's 14-year-old Kathy
Devine. I want to bash on Seattle.
Okay.
So, the Pacific Northwest, I've never been. My limited knowledge of the Pacific Northwest is that it's cold and wet and foggy all the frickin' time.
Yeah, I think,
why would anybody want
to go there? Think it's as bad as we think it is.
Possibly.
I hear it time and time again, but I think what's worse is Portland. It's grungy, it's nasty, but we shouldn't.
Every city that's on the planet, Seattle, Chicago, I would like to eventually experience it.
Seattle too.
Seattle's really, 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 really low on that list. Okay, go ahead.
14-year-old Kathy Devine is running away from home. I remember having an argument, yelling and having a meltdown when I was 10, telling my mom I'm going to run away from home.
My mom said, don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out.
I put my pants and a shirt or whatever, and I grabbed him and I ran downstairs, and my mom said, I don't have time for that right now. That's all she said.
Now, so, I think there is some question as to whether she was actually running away or she just had a fight. So to say that she was actually running away, I think may be a dramatic interpretation of that. But
she accepts a ride from a brown pickup truck, and her two friends who were with her saw her. And then one of them later got a little anxious and called Kathy's family to tell her what's going on. Here is her sister, Sherry.
I remember it as about 3 hours after she left, one of the girls that was with her got a case of conscience and called my mom, said, I just thought you might need to know.
To know that she had accepted a ride with a complete stranger and just all of a sudden disappeared from our sight and then never take anything with her. She had most of her personal belongings were at home. We knew she was in trouble.
So that second voice was her father, Bill. So she had left most of her personal items at home. And if you're a 14-year-old and you're going to run away, you're not going to leave your purse and your...
That's why this leads me to believe she wasn't actually trying to run away. It was just anger trying to get out of the situation.
So her father has spoken with the police. 2 days go by and they hear nothing. And since it's 1973 at Seattle, her father's a realist. They're probably never going to hear from her again.
Isn't that horrible?
It's terrible.
Not a phone call, nothing. And at that point, by Sunday night, I was convinced that she would never call us because she would have called by then. I was terrified about it. I really was.
So on December 6th, 11 days later, we're in Olympia, Washington, which is the next county over. I believe there's a city of Olympia, but Olympia.
Do you have any idea what the, like an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, do you have any idea the difference?
I think it's 90 minutes.
Okay, 90 minutes, okay.
So Barbara Salling is walking through a state park picking up trash left by visitors when she spots what she thinks is a mannequin, and Jack, it's never a mannequin.
But think about it.
It's terrible.
It's the 70s. Yeah. It's a more innocent time. So this woman's thinking, oh, somebody drove it.
I don't know.
A mannequin out here, threw it in the woods.
Sadly, it's not. This is what Barbara sees.
I was going to pick it up as trash. And when I get closer, I noticed her buttocks, and it was definitely not a mannequin.
So she calls the police, and the detectives from Thurston County immediately show up. And this is Deputy Chief Dwight Caron. He's retired, and he's talking about what they found when they arrived at the scene. And it's raining.
Imagine that.
Washington State. So
Pacific Northwest.
Evidence is very quickly being washed away.
She was facing face down in the salal. Her face was pretty badly, eroded away, if you will.
So they find a bunch of pieces of evidence. There's a piece of rope. There's some jewelry. But very importantly, decades later, There is a missing shoe. They only find one of her shoes.
And the horrible, well, the horrible thing is the shoes were very distinctive.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 70s, the late 70s, you remember
the shit Marsha Brady used to wear?
Oh, wow,
and those big chunky heels?
Well, but this is crunchy
granola.
Granola Pacific Next Northwest. Up. Everybody in the late 70s had those.
Early 70s.
Well, in the late 70s, I remember the late 70s in Parkersburg, you wore those hiking boots that had the black soles that were brown suede and had the big red laces.
Uh-huh.
Those were the boots.
Yeah.
So, the Washington State.
Oh, well,
State.
we get to it later, what he actually calls them.
Right. So, yeah.
There's obvious indications of sexual assault. We won't go into detail on that. At this point, she is a Jane Doe. We don't know who this victim is.
Has it been mentioned yet? I cannot remember if they said during the episode that part of the reason that the initial investigation was so hot and heavy was because they assumed it was a Ted Bundy victim.
No.
Oh, so that's something I got in my research. They assumed that she was a Ted Bundy
victim. She fits the profile.
At the very beginning
Perfectly.
Of this.
Yeah, young teenage girl abducted out of the blue. Due to decomposition, they can't tell if she's been strangled or her throat's been cut. Either way, it's terrifying. In an attempt to identify her, they turn to the nearest big city, which is, of course, Seattle.
We couldn't put her in the county as a resident. And we're wondering, you know, how she got here. Hitchhiking was, of course, the first thing that came to our mind.
So the local news runs a feature on this Jane Doe showing the items that they found. And there's a very distinct dragon patch.
Yeah.
That she had on her coat. And her sister immediately identifies it.
And I knew it immediately. She had a patch that was a dragon. Very unique because she'd taken it off another piece of clothing. And I looked at my mom and I said, Mom, that's Kathy. You need to call the police.
So the detectives from Thurston County, not Seattle, but where the body is found, they head to Seattle and where Kathy lived, and they begin interviewing people. But other than that brown truck, they can't get much information, and the case starts going cold, which I think was pretty common back then.
Well, yeah.
Because we have so many tools. Now, if that had happened now, that guy would have been caught that same day.
Think about it. If that happened now, there are videos on every corner.
Scanners of license plates.
Cell phones, scanners of license plates. There are so many
tracking devices.
Technological advances that this would not have taken this long.
No. And they kept cutting away to Selectra typewriters and things showing the equipment.
Well, it was the 70s.
The near distant past. So when it goes cold, retired detective Paul Bartcliffe began going through police reports from around the same time that Kathy went missing. And he comes across the case of a truck that was set on fire, which seems suspicious to him.
First thing I come across was Carson's truck burning in the middle of the night.
So this is the first mention of William Cosden, a local thug with a bad reputation and a police record.
And that's part of it. The detective was like, wait a minute, this guy's car caught on fire? Mm-hmm. You could see like the aha moment.
He was putting two and two together. Yep. So this is Captain Mark Curtis of the Thurston County Sheriff's Office. He's talking about the two anonymous tips that were literally physically mailed to the office.
That's a little, that's odd.
Well, they had no other way to contact him.
I guess it's pre, just call?
This is pre-email.
I know. I'm thinking, I forget it's 1973.
We had two tips mailed in anonymously suggesting William Cosden Jr. is who we should look at. It was an anonymous tip, and you'd really never know what to expect. But when there's two of them, certainly somebody ought to take some notice, and we did.
So if it was just one anonymous tip, you might just dismiss it as somebody with a vendetta with the person. But two anonymous tips, that carries some weight with it. So now the cops start digging into Cosden's past, and they find out in 1967, this is 5 years earlier, he was charged with the rape and murder of a woman in Maryland and was sent to a home for the criminally insane. And how the hell he ever got out of there by 1973 is beyond me. Did you find anything?
No, but that was what I was going to say. Kevin, repeat that. 1967, he was charged with rape and murder of a woman in Maryland.
Right.
And in less than...
It's 5 years later.
5 years, And it's like, wait, you are already out and living your life?
And you couldn't find anything about the thing in Maryland?
No. I found the article about it, you know, about it, but other than the same information you just have.
All right.
I think it's because of the time.
That's maybe it's sealed. Yeah. I don't know. At any rate, when he gets out, he heads to the West Coast, starts working at a truck stop that his father owned.
Well, that's why he went there.
Mm-hmm.
It was where his father owned a business.
Back then, truckers kept their mouths shut. So when the police came around, it was no different. But eventually, they got one trucker to talk. By the way, the rest stop is called the Restover Truck Stop in Olympia, Washington. It's still open.
Oh, my.
They have a Facebook page that has not been updated since 2012, but they do have an active, they're active on triptychs and all that
I'm
other stuff.
Curious if it's still owned by the same family.
It looks the same. They've updated the sign, and they updated some of the other stuff, but it looks exactly like the photos from this.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's where this happened. So the one trucker willing to talk said they saw him and his clothes were bloody, and he asked him what was going on.
Didn't the
people? Yeah, the guy knew him.
The people who spoke actually knew him.
Constant.
It's not like some random
person.
No,
no, no. And they said,
some weirdo came in.
What's with the blood on your clothes? And
right.
He was like, oh, I was poaching deer. People use hunting so often to cover up the crimes, and it's like, oh, it's deer blood.
Yeah.
So, that actually, last week's episode, I think the guy said, what was that? That same night, the truck goes up in flames. So with no other witnesses and the truck destroyed, Cosden is literally put on the back burner. So we jump to the summer of 2001.
2001.
So this is 28 years later. And Cosden is in jail for raping another woman.
And he's not aged well. You know how I always say about when you see the pictures.
These people never
do. He's not aged well.
Jeremy Sanderson is a forensic scientist for the state of Washington. We got forensic in there. He takes a sample from the semen that was recovered from our victim all those years later.
Okay, now immediately, I got to interrupt you.
Uh-huh.
How did they store that?
I was going to say that I know that they kept evidence back then, hoping that in the future technology would advance. But that was not only some great evidence collection,
yes,
but
was.
Management, because so often they'll go back and they're like, "That's
lost.
We lost it."
So my question is was, so if anybody can answer this question, it would be like, I would love to know this, because I'm still trying to find a
blood expert.
that will talk to us. If there was a sample from 1973 and it's currently 2001, it couldn't have been a real biological sample.
It was a dried sample. Yeah, there's DNA in a dried sample.
But I thought that would have degraded by
then. It doesn't always.
So what I was assuming is they did all these tests on it and they had the test reports. So then if they got another sample later, they could compare it to the original test reports. That's what I thought.
That's not what happened. No.
So a dried sample.
DNA was not available in 73.
Okay.
It really only came into popular use in the 90s, and by 2001 they were leaps and bounds, but they were able to extract a viable profile from this sample, which I thought was amazing.
It's amazing.
He runs it through the state database and they don't get anything. I almost said CODIS, but it wasn't CODIS. It was just Washington State. But the detectives working this case had gotten a blood sample from Cosden, and they said, hey, Sanderson, can you compare the DNA in this blood sample to the sample from the victim? And he does, and this is what happens.
After I had done that without a hit, then just as this housekeeping item, well, could you run his blood sample also? We found this. Maybe it'd be valuable, so go ahead. Why don't you try it out?
The sample detectives give Sanderson is William Cosden's. The analysis is straightforward. The results, unequivocal. What DNA analysts call a 13-locus match. Pretty much as good as it gets.
The probability of selecting somebody else at random and they're coincidentally also having a matching profile that was found to be shared between William Cosden and the semen sample was approximately 1 in 71 trillion.
So they get that 1 in a quintillion match. It's like it's the best match you can get. And so now they can at least confirm Cosden had sex with her, with Kathy, the 14-year-old victim.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily mean he killed her. So they want to get him in and get him talking. So they get Cosden into an interview room and they see if they can get him to make a mistake. They show him the DNA evidence and this is what he says.
Yeah.
And I says, Bill, if you never had any contact with Catherine before, you never seen her before, you never had sex with her or anything else, how did your sperm get in her vagina? And his only response to that was, I haven't killed anyone. It's got to be a mistake.
So they say there are still a lot of witnesses who are still alive 28 years after the murder. So they go back to the truck stop and they end up speaking to David Pershawn, who was a regular back in the day. And we hear, we actually see the cassette rolling
right.
of him being interviewed on a cassette tape. It's funny, 2001 seems... It's 22 years ago, but you'd expect to see them with a cell phone holding that, and it's a cassette tape. It just jumped.
And it scares me, just to get off the subject for just a second, mm-hmm. it scares me how technology, like, it used to take 100 years for something to change, and then it took 50 years for something to change, and then it took 20, and now it's like...
iPhone 17.
Your phone is 2 years old, it might as well be
a dinosaur bone.
Oh.
So, anyway, here's his interview.
Did you see anything suspicious in the back of that truck?
Seen that sleeping bag was all bloody. And then I seen that brown walking stomper shoe. And it had some kind of dark laces in it.
So remember the missing shoe from the beginning of the episode?
Exactly!
David calls it a waffle stomper.
Because that's what I remember
that. That sounds like something Pam would have worn.
I remember that. Pam, I will bet you $100,000 our friend Pam had a pair of those.
Waffle stompers. So it matches the description of the shoe that Kathy was wearing exactly. It's extremely damning evidence. He also saw a bloody sleeping bag. So on March 8th, 2002, Costin is charged with rape and murder. 2 months later, a jury convicts him, and he is sentenced to life in prison. He's there to this day, I believe.
He's there to this day. And it's very interesting because, as Kevin said, he was already in jail.
Right.
He was in jail.
He was in jail for rape, but he could have gotten back out, you know?
Yes, but it was a 38-year sentence.
Well,
this was, you know...
Well, this just threw away the key. But it's amazing that a crime in 1973, and this is happening more and more,
right.
28 years later, keep those samples. They kept those samples. I can't imagine they were like, these samples are no, what, I don't even,
right.
you know,
it's
know,
they
envision DNA.
Well, you know, I always make that joke about that movie from a while ago called Gattaca, mm-hmm. where literally they're using eyelashes and skin flakes to genetically profile people.
Yeah.
It is now.
It's here.
I don't think it's ever going to be quite like that.
I never saw Gattaca. Was that any good?
It was an odd movie. It's just a very odd movie.
Who was the lead actor in that? He kind of fell off the map.
Really pretentious. He was in Reality Bites uh-huh. his name. Oh,
Dead Poets Society.
Uma Thurman is the girl,
uh-huh.
and Jude Law, I believe, is
that's not what I'm thinking of. It's the other guy.
No. The guy you're thinking. What's his name?
Yeah.
Oh,
he's kind of has been now.
he was just recently in something else. He's got that narrow face. He's like a cut rate Kiefer Sutherland.
There you go.
Oh shit! It doesn't matter. Anyway, but the whole point of what I was trying to say was that. In the next, I think in our lifetimes, it's going to be, they're going to be able to extract DNA and or something else down to breath moisture
right.
and to that kind
Very
of
little,
stuff.
Yeah, speaking yeah. of Jude Law, AI has been running on Pluto, the movie AI.
Yes.
And Jude Law is the sex bot.
Yes.
He's Mecca.
Yes.
And he played that movie are good.
That movie made me cry, and the friend that I went to saw it with goes, you're crying over a toaster.
I cried too. I cried too at the end.
Well, I cry. I'm emotional.
Haley
I cry
Joe.
About shit like that. You're crying over a toaster.
Haley Joe Osment did not age well. That poor
no,
kid.
He is not.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. That's the sad story of Kathy Devine. And you got some more? You got stuff?
I think. So the witnesses at the truck stop that saw his truck and everything with all the mm-hmm. bloody... that's something I don't understand. There's a bloody sleeping bag in the back of your
that's
truck.
That's not a deer.
And you just... You think no one's going to notice that. So he literally... It was 3 miles from the truck stop.
Mm-hmm.
So he drove away from work, set his truck on fire, and walked back to work.
That's not fishy. Not even for the 1970s.
I know, exactly.
What is this, 1992 Seattle?
Exactly. So what I was trying to say earlier, and I got the dates, the time wrong. He was in prison serving a 48-year sentence for first-degree rape when he was charged with the murder.
Okay.
So a 48-year, that's
he
almost
He was probably going to die in prison,
that's
but
almost a life
the family
anyway.
Got justice yeah, for yeah. Kathy.
He last appeared before the state's sentencing board for parole in May of 1999. The board declined to grant him parole in part because he wrote some kind of rambling pornographic discourse while he was in jail, indicating he may not be rehabilitized. Said board chairman John Austin.
People like that can't be rehabilitated. It's just not possible.
Edwards, I believe he was the detective in this thing, said Costin is a person of interest in other criminal investigations.
You bet.
But he declined to provide details because, of course, the way things are set up at the time, there's no way to go back. And like I told you before, this girl was considered a Ted Bundy victim.
Makes sense.
And I think Costin was like kind of not flying under the radar, but like, see what I can get away with.
Boy, creepy.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. All right. Well,
people are horrible.
They are horrible. But thank you for listening. And,
yes. Like, subscribe, share with your friends.
And don't kill people.
Don't kill. Just leave.
Just leave. Thank you.
Thank you. Au revoir, man. The ass will be. The girl can't help it. She's in love with me. Can't help it. The girl can't help it.